Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets, from vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters, your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net.
Memoirs about people from cultures different than your own want you to read them. They are not writing for their own, and I think that's the biggest kind of takeaway.
Vivian Halloran looked at food memoirs for her book, The Immigrant Kitchen. She'll talk about the complicated notion of authentic cuisine today on Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. From Harvest, we hear how ranchers are divided on what power the federal government should wield when regulating big meat companies. And on the ingredients list with Daniel Orr, cashews, orange, gouda, garam masala, and carrots. News. Mark, what's up?
Hey, Annie. Two stories this week. First, India's central government told the country's Supreme Court last month that more than 12,000 farmers have committed suicide per year since 2013. The testimony was part of an ongoing case filed in January. Advocacy group Citizens Resource and Action Initiative filed a petition to seek compensation for debt-ridden families affected by suicides in the particularly hard-hit region of Gujarat. The case could have implications for federal crop insurance rates and subsidies. The government says poverty, high debt, and crop failures are to blame. The government has also stated that farmer suicides rose 42% between 2014 and 2015, and pointed out that several states have battled drought for the last few years. The cause of farmer suicides has been a source of controversy in India for many years. Some advocates blame the use of genetically modified crops, like BT cotton, which costs more to grow and drives farmers into deeper debt. But some studies have cast doubt on the connection between GM crops and suicides. A study last year showed that while rates of farmers committing suicide is lower than that of non-farmers, farmers are more likely to commit suicide because of economic stress compared to other groups. And as cities and towns across North America grapple with the dangers and benefits of backyard chickens, advocates are looking for creative solutions. In Windsor, Canada, a dozen small-scale chicken raisers formed a cooperative to get around restrictions on backyard birds. Their group shares space outside city limits, pools labor, and access to sustainable food sources like spent grain from a brewery. Domestic fowl are banned within the Windsor city limits, but they're allowed in the country. Big cities like New York, Chicago, and San Francisco allow limited raising of backyard fowl, while some urban areas are cracking down with more restrictions. Washington, D.C. has floated a ban on backyard chickens, making it clear that chickens are not considered a, quote, common cage bird, closing a possible loophole in pet ownership. You hear news stories like these on the weekly show, and they're always also posted at eartheats.org.
And on Twitter, at EarthEats. Mark Chilla is on Twitter at mchilla.
That's right. Thanks, Annie.
What we eat and what we grow will have to change as our climate changes. Farmers and ranchers are likely to face extreme swings in temperature and precipitation, and they'll have to deal with more pests and diseases. Scientists are working to find novel ways to help farmers adapt to a changing climate. But as Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports, with a new administration in Washington, D.C., comes a new focus.
There's nothing flashy about the U.S. Department of Agriculture's research office in Fort Collins, Colorado. It's a squat, beige building hidden behind a series of greenhouses.
Come on in. Welcome to the illustrious Crops Lab.
Thank you.
But the scientists that work here, like Danelle Peck, say they're doing the work necessary to keep America's farmers and ranchers from withering away in a worst-case climate change scenario.
We are here to try and make weather and climate information and research more accessible, more useful, more usable.
Peck is in charge of a project based out of this office called the Northern Plains Climate Hub. Essentially, Peck and her team act as translators. They break down scientific jargon from climate researchers, putting new discoveries like drought-tolerant crops into layman's terms for farmers and ranchers.
One part of the hub's creation was to make us more efficient, right? If we have many, many different people out working on weather and climate issues and they don't talk to each other, then you get redundancy or, you know, duplication.
This climate hub is one of 10 set up across the country during the Obama administration. They're still up and running now under the reins of a new president, Donald Trump, who has repeatedly called climate change a hoax.
Yeah, farmers care about this a lot.
Roger Johnson is the president of the National Farmers Union, a left-leaning lobby group. He was a North Dakota farmer for the majority of his life.
What farmers really want is good, solid, scientific information about how they can better operate their farms and ranches.
But that solid scientific information from publicly funded scientists is in jeopardy, Johnson says.
It looks really fuzzy right now. It looks like, you know, there are a bunch of sort of science deniers, climate deniers that have largely been installed in high levels in this administration.
Trump's new USDA secretary, Sonny Perdue, is now overseeing the agency's climate change projects, like those 10 climate hubs. He doesn't deny climate change is happening, but injects seeds of doubt about humanity's role in causing it.
I've been on a farm since the early 50s, and I can tell you the climate is changing, but the fact of what are the cause of it is really what is in dispute.
Nearly every climate scientist in the world disagrees. So do portions of the USDA's website that say unequivocally climate change is man-made. But similar statements are slowly being scrubbed from other federal websites, leading some to question the Trump administration's commitment to well-established climate science.
I think that there is a general feeling of concern.
Charles Rice is a soil microbiologist at Kansas State University. He's received USDA grants to look at how farmers might adapt to a hotter climate. The most recent federal budget maintains or even boosts scientific research funding. But Rice says the administration's rhetoric matters. Any pause in current research could have drastic effects down the line.
Because it takes 20 or 30 years to develop a new crop variety, and so even a short-term reduction or priority change will have a long-term implication on research for plant development.
The Trump administration will find it difficult to cut climate change research across the board. It's integrated into the work of so many federal agencies. And funding for the USDA's climate hubs has yet to change. But projects with a climate change focus, like the research hubs, will likely be under the microscope. Agriculture Secretary Perdue says his office will be looking at how the hubs came to be. And he says if they're found to have an ideological bent, USDA might find a, quote, better way to research. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
More at harvestpublicmedia.org. Memoirs are a form of hospitality. The author is inviting you into their home, their culture, their food traditions. And then when the memoirs contains recipes, it's like an extended meal. That's how Vivian Halloran sees it. She's the author of The Immigrant Kitchen, Food, Ethnicity, and the Diaspora. She came into the Earth Eats studios earlier this year to speak with Lee Bush and Maddie Chera of the Indiana University Food Institute. It just seemed right to start a conversation about food memoirs with personal stories. You'll hear Lee first, then Vivian.
So I grew up on the East Coast, and I grew up eating gefilte fish with my Jewish friends and ziti with my Italian friends, Irish soda bread with my Irish Catholic friends. And at home, my mom would make homemade tortillas all the time. And it wasn't until way later in life that I realized that other people didn't actually eat homemade tortillas. And also that this came from my grandfather, who was native New Mexican. And I didn't realize that in terms of immigration, he was a second language English speaker. So he grew up speaking Spanish. Second language was English. And yet his ancestors came in the 1500s to New Mexico. So, like most of us in the U.S., you're an immigrant as well. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your ancestry and what had you come to the mainland U.S.
Well, it's kind of an interesting story because you talked about someone who stayed in place once they immigrated to the New World and that the border moved around them. Right. So but the tradition of speaking Spanish remained within the family, which made him so much later than the 1500s, a Spanish speaker first. In my case, my father's side of the family came from what was, at the time they left, still considered Syria. And they went first to Cuba, and then they settled in Puerto Rico. So I grew up with great-grandparents who would argue back and forth in Arabic. And my grandfather was the youngest of 11. My relatives, their deal was restaurants. So that's how they made their living in Puerto Rico when I was growing up. All that to say is that I grew up watching my dad have these moments where he'd be homesick for Lebanese food. And my mother, her father was a Spaniard, and so she did not know how to do this. So we'd get in the car and go over to the Lebanese side of the family, and they would not only feed him then, but give him a whole bunch of foods to tide him over. But I really saw this as a fascinating aspect of his background. I never thought that I was Lebanese, but I knew that we were one of the five Lebanese families in Puerto Rico at the time. And then later, when I was a sophomore in high school, we left Puerto Rico due to health reasons. My sister needed medical care. My dad was in the Army, so Fitzsimmons Army Medical Base in Colorado was the place we needed to be. And so we moved there, but it took my dad a year to find a compassionate reassignment, somebody who'd swap jobs with him. Wow. And it's in that period when we were first in Colorado waiting for my dad that the neighbors got together and left us this basket of wonderful Thanksgiving goodies. And it was such a warm and welcoming act.
And yet you said they left a card that was not signed by anyone?
Yeah, that's the thing. They were trying to minimize then the potential shame we might have felt. And that's a funny kind of gesture, right? Because it's both a welcome to our neighborhood, we valued you, but also you probably don't know what we do, right? So we took it in the spirit in which it was offered. And a year later, he was able to join us, and so our family was reunited.
You also talk about how the immigrant memoir cookbooks give you a glimpse into exemplary immigrants. What do you mean by that?
Well, part of the problem, if there is one, with choosing this data set, right, this assortment of memoirs, is that most of the people who have the time to both reflect on their experience and then write about it are people who are middle class or upper income. So there's a level in which their experience is indeed the one to whom people refer when they're saying, oh, good immigrants. So I am aware that to not cover them, not mention the people who struggle, who maybe cross boundaries and don't have proper documents,
right,
they're not able to shine a light on their own day-to-day life.
You commented on how the recipe format has changed, too, over time. Could you maybe explain what that change has been like?
Recipe books started being written as a way of transmitting a specific series of ingredients, but not techniques for what to do with them, because they were addressed to people who cooked for a living. Mm-hmm. And then the less familiar people are with cooking, the more explanation that recipes have to have. Now, the interesting thing I discovered is when you write a memoir, you don't need to taste test your recipes. And so you can very easily tell who is having a recipe they've never actually made.
Yes, and I have had that experience with chefs having to make their recipes for them and write them down.
Yeah, and so, again, when authors write about, oh, we used to go to this fancy restaurant when I was five, and then suddenly at the end of the chapter, there's this recipe for a restaurant that's been out of business for a long time. You know a five-year-old didn't write that down, right? So there's a bit of an element that is constructed. Yes, they went. Yes, they ate this. Yes, their memories are fine. But this is an approximation, and you need to know that.
And oftentimes, the fewer specialty ingredients are included that sometimes make the recipe or remind you so much of the cultural heritage of that recipe. Mm-hmm. I think of dried limes in the cookbook Plenty mm-hmm. and palm sugar and some mm-hmm. of in the cookbook Fat Rice.
And yet, just having to make those substitutions absolutely demonstrate what the process of assimilating to the culture that you're living in, you know, or acculturating, right? It's that you make certain trade-offs in order to get the end result, which is the meal you're yearning for.
Right.
And it can't be authentic if you don't have the ingredients you need, and yet it can be real.
So for you, what's the difference between authentic and real? Because as food scholars, we deal with these ideas a lot, but they're contested and confusing. So what's your take on?
Well, you know, it also goes to that notion of who is the arbiter. Because if you're making the recipe in the way your grandmother and your great-grandmother always made it, but it turns out that their use of ingredients was an accommodation, I think it's authentic to your family, but it may not meet the originality of the ingredients that would make it authentically X cuisine. And in some of the memoirs that I read, actually the ravioli book mm-hmm. talked about this whole search about the original recipe for this ravioli. It turns out the grandma used cream cheese because she liked it better. So it was authentically her family, but right. it was not authentic to like the region in Italy that she could trace her her pedigree to.
So much of the story of immigration and food is about making those changes based on what's available. And yeah. so that's kind of part of the process.
Yeah. And actually, it's also the community building. So in some of the memoirs, what is so striking is that the family would gear up for a day's drive to go acquire authentic ingredients. Mm-hmm. Say, if you lived in Indiana, you'd go to Chicago and buy and stock up for a long time, but then you'd have peanut butter and jelly sandwiches to tide you over, so you didn't have to stop. You could just get there and spend a lot of time. And then, you know, at a certain point, the second or third generation says, well, it's okay that I use it with this because it reflects my reality.
Yeah. And also you talked about what we choose to eat and how we choose to eat and who we choose to eat in front of. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about how that is featured with your kids, with people you know, with you as a child?
Yes, I think that in the memoirs in particular, in the lunchroom at the school cafeteria becomes mm-hmm. the site in which these identities are really hashed out. Recent immigrant children not only have the barrier of language, but also bring foods that they're comfortable with to the school cafeteria, and then they face that double rejection, maybe triple. It could be racial. It could be because of their linguistic inability to communicate with their friends, and then the smell of the food. So I think my children, when they're feeling most peevish, right, or more like they want to tease me, they tease me about my accent, and then they teach me about my smelly foods that I eat.
Oh, it's like you need to learn a gastronomic code switching in order to be proficient.
And kids do. And a lot of these memoirs, you know, the kids come home, it's like, I must have peanut butter and sandwich. I don't want to draw any attention to me. But then somebody like Diana Abu Jaber, who is her father is Jordanian and her mother was American, made a point of defiantly continuing to bring this food because it's delicious. And then gradually she saw the opposite. Oh, the kids are like, ooh, can I have some of that hummus? She took a perverse pride in being able to convert people to her ethnic way of eating.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for speaking with us
you.
Today.
Yeah,
it was really fun. A pleasure.
Vivian Halloran wrote the book Immigrant Kitchen. She's also an associate professor of English and American Studies at Indiana University. Thanks to Lee Bush and Maddie Chera of IU's Food Institute for that conversation. This interview originally aired in February of this year. Coming up, you need a couple new recipes for carrots. You do. And we have some ideas. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Needmore Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. on the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. I'm Annie. This is Earth Eats. Shopping advice from the man, Chef Daniel Orr. You may have heard him say it before that 90% of being a good chef is being a good shopper. So here's a little tip for picking out carrots.
If you go to find some nice organic carrots, you want to have them with the greens very, very vibrant looking. So that's the way you can tell that they haven't been around for too long, because as they get older, they will wilt. Okay, and then the first thing you want to do when you bring these home is cut those off, because these will continue to feed off the root of the carrot. The greens will. So they'll actually suck moisture and nutritional value out of the carrot. Now, that doesn't mean that you want to throw these away. These can be very good. You wash them very well, and you can add them to salads. You can use them for garnishing like you would parsley. I even deep fry them and use them as a fried garnish. And you can chop them up and use them as an herb. So don't just throw these away. Save the best ones, wash them really well, and go ahead and use that, because you're paying just as much for the tops as you are for the roots. So you don't want to throw away that money.
Or how about a carrot greens pesto? That's what Chef Arlen Llewellyn will be making for us in a bit. Two new ideas for preparing carrots. Maybe you love carrots, or maybe you're bored with carrots. We're aiming to give you new recipes for the old spring standbys.
Okay, today we're going to do a Moroccan salad, and it's a recipe that I learned from a French mentor of mine, Madame Masson, and she loved to vacation in Morocco, and she just fell in love with it, and in turn, I fell in love with this salad. I still haven't been to Morocco, but if anybody wants to take me, let me know. All right, so we're going to have about 2 cups of carrots. We're going to add about a teaspoon of turmeric, a teaspoon of garam masala, which is a kind of a North African spice. I'm going to add a little bit of my favorite herb, garlic. That's about a teaspoon. Then we're going to add some ginger. Ginger and garlic love to play together. I'm going to add a little bit of olive oil. That's about a tablespoon. Add the juice of half an orange. I'm going to finish this with a little salt and pepper. And we'll give that a toss. Okay, and taste. Just going to stack that up kind of like a haystack. Go to my trusty garnish bottle of roasted red pepper coulis. And as Madame Masson would say, bon appetit! Oh, that was Julia Child.
Now, about those greens. Until recently, I didn't know that you could eat carrot greens. I learned that from Daniel. Chef Arlen Llewellyn was just like me, and then she placed an order with one of her farmers, Jim Bauman of Freedom Valley Farm.
And we were talking to him about carrots, and he said, well, do you want to do anything with the tops? Because I've got a bunch of those. And I looked at him, and he was like, they make a great pesto. And it turns out that's a whole thing, but I didn't know anything about that.
We visited her in the small kitchen at Function Brewing a couple years ago for this recipe. The pesto is one of several components that will go onto her wood nymph panini.
So pesto, as you may know, is an amazing base recipe because it's a simple ratio of ingredients, and you can substitute almost any aspect of those out. So you can use almost any leafy vegetable for the basil. You can use almost any form of acid for the lemon juice, any form of nut for the pine nuts that are traditionally in it. So we use aged Gouda instead of Parmesan. We use that in a couple different components in our recipes in-house, and I think it makes a great addition to pesto. And cashews, which we use instead of pine nuts. I would hold off on adding any of the oil, because you really want this hard stuff to be forced to be broken down by the food processor blade. If you start adding oil in there, it's just going to swim around the blade rather than being broken down. All right, I'm going to start grinding this up, pulsing it. Adding the oil in. So that's the reason for the handy little hole at the top of the food processor, is to be able to do something like this. Also, how you would do, for instance, mayonnaise, is to just stream it in very slowly.
How many different types of cheese do you have in this place?
Oh my gosh. On sandwiches alone, we have aged Gouda, smoked Gouda, aged cheddar, Havarti, pepper jack, and smoked blue cheese. We have Capriole goat cheese, which we use in an appetizer. We have 5 cheeses for the cheese plate. And we have feta, which we make into sun-dried tomato whipped feta and that we put on salads. That didn't count, but that's a lot, right? Cheese and vegetables. I mean, I guess we've opened a cheese and vegetable restaurant with some bread and some meat on the side.
The sandwiches at Function are intense. There's a lot going on between the 2 slices of bread. Llewellyn has a very specific way of constructing each of the sandwiches. With this one, the carrot top pesto goes on the bottom, so that's the first flavor that hits your tongue after you bite through the bread.
That's a nice thing about sandwiches, is that as a chef, is that you can control how the customer is going to experience it, whereas if you're putting things on a plate and they're just diving in with a knife and fork, they may not eat it in the sequence that you would want them to. In a sandwich, they're kind of forced to. So we're just gonna spread the pesto on. I do not believe in less is more a lot of times. I think more is great when you're talking about flavor components. And make sure to take it all the way to the side so that you're not getting any bland bites in there. So this is the raisin aioli. We plumped the raisins in a water steam bath and then blended them with mayonnaise. So these are roasted local carrots, braised collard greens, braised in a little bit of butter and salt and pepper. We are going to top that with some blue cheese and then some Fair Oaks Havarti and the raisin aioli, and that will seal the deal. So we're going to go ahead and put this on the panini press.
No stovetops in the Function kitchen, so these panini presses work hard for Llewellyn and her staff.
I'd say we're pretty good. We're just going to let that sit. It's very important to let sandwiches rest for a couple minutes. Because right now that bottom piece of bread is super hot. So if you put it on a flat surface, it's going to steam on the inside up against the plate and the bottom piece will be soggy. So we put it on that resting rack for a couple minutes to lose the most intense heat before we cut it and before we put it on a plate.
Wow. The sandwich looks ridiculous.
Thank you. It's hopefully a good mix of unctuous richness, but also things that make you feel like you're eating something good for you.
Thanks so much to Arlen and Daniel for the snacks today. Pictures and recipes at eartheats.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. I'm Annie Corrigan. Bye-bye.